Thursday of this week, America will commemorate the 150th anniversary of the birth of its 16th president. Well over 1,000 encomiums will be spoken at Lincoln Day luncheons and dinners in honor of a man who has been called the patron saint of American democracy. Were Lincoln to hear himself described as a saint, I am sure a wry smile would come to his face. For how often in the heat of political campaigning he was damned for his unwillingness to join any individual church, branded a heretic and an atheist. And yet Mr. Lincoln was a deeply religious man. And historically, I think it is not at all inapt to consider Lincoln as the patron saint of our democracy. We have been blessed in American political life with many great presidents, men whom we applaud and who we respect. We respect a Washington who brought to the revolution the courtly manners and the conservative spirit of a true aristocrat. We bless and we respect a Jefferson who, though brought up in the genteel tradition of another age, developed the philosophy of the democratic way of life, a philosophy which we still find enlightening and ennobling today. We respect and we applaud a Wilson who left the academic world to give to the larger world a vision of nations united in one world organization, willing through that organization to settle their differences around a table rather than in the battlefield. We bless and respect a Roosevelt who overcame physical debility and found an immense reservoir of spiritual strength which enabled him to cure our nation's economic ills and to limit the spread of the cancer of tyranny which threatened to engulf the world. We respect these men and we respect Mr. Lincoln. We respect him for having prosecuted successfully a terribly miserable civil war, for having been able to bind our nation back together as one whole. We respect him for having uprooted the weed of slavery, that pernicious weed, for having destroyed human bondage once and for all from this continent. There is respect in our minds for Mr. Lincoln, but there is also love in our hearts. It is that love which distinguishes, I think, our relationship to Lincoln from our relationship to that of any other of our presidents. For it is not only what Lincoln achieved, but the man that he was, which endears him to us. He was a man of rare qualities of spirit, a man of definite moral purpose in life, but this moral purpose was wedded to an infinitely deep reservoir of human sympathy. He spoke with the tongue of a prophet. He wrote with the pen of a philosopher and a statesman. He lived by the highest of the codes of self-restraint and of human conduct. Truly, this man we love and revere, as well as respect and venerate. So much so that over 20,000 volumes of biography and of research study have been written on the life of Mr. Lincoln. So much so that one of our ablest of modern poets, Mr. Carl Sandburg, has spent over 3 decades of his life preparing a monumental biography of Lincoln's life and his person and his philosophy and his purpose. And sometimes our veneration of Mr. Lincoln has led us into excess. For surely there are today 2 Lincolns, a Lincoln of history and a Lincoln of legend. The Lincoln of legend sees greatness already in the tattered urchin playing in the sandy bottom of Knob Creek in Kentucky. The Lincoln of history sees a politician become statesman and finds greatness in the man who could preach mercy in an age of anger, self-control in an age of high passion. I prefer, I think you do, the Lincoln of history. For man is, after all, a frail, infallible being, Perfection, if there is such in this world, belongs to some higher order of species, not to us. And it is not so much that men make mistakes that fault them in our eyes, but we judge a man harshly only if he fails to pay attention to correcting and rectifying these mistakes and improving on his character. And surely there is hardly any connection between the Lincoln who had to win the acclaim of his townsmen in New Salem by out-wrestling the biggest bully of the community, to the Lincoln who won the acclaim of his fellow countrymen throughout this nation by preaching a doctrine of charity to all and anger towards none. This is the Lincoln whom we revere, the Lincoln whom we respect, the Lincoln whom we love. Lincoln was 6'4" in height, his biographers tell us, yet we measure the height of his character by quite another standard. The distance between the door of the cabin into which he was raised as an orphan stepchild to the distance which brought him to the door of the White House, where he raised the American flag in pride and with honor. I am proud of this Lincoln of history, and I find that knowing that in his early life he pamphleteered with more concern with to defame the personality of his opponent than to prosecute the ideals of his platform, or that in his early business activities he prosecuted these business ventures with more slipshodness and a bit more of haphazard than we might expect, or that in his early political life he was more concerned with winning for his constituents some pork barrel type of legislative privilege than he was with achieving for his whole state, for the whole community, programs necessary to them. I find that knowing these facts not to one whit lowers in my mind the estimation of Mr. Lincoln. It only raises in my heart an amazing awareness of the distance which Lincoln managed to cover. The distance which brought a boy raised in a home quite ordinary and quite common to a pitch of extraordinary nobility, to a standard of life and of conduct of extraordinary capacity. Arthur Schlesinger Sr., one of our better professors of American history, made some years ago what I consider to be a cryptic comment of the nature of Lincoln and of his relationships to Lincoln research. He said that he found any rehearsal of the story of Lincoln to be ennobling, but to be at the same time quite disturbing. I think I understand now something of what he meant, for Lincoln's life is disturbing. Lincoln's father was one of these vagabond, ne'er-do-well types who could never set down roots in any community. He was never able to achieve any measure of status in his various occupations, nor any measure of financial success at farming or any other venture. Lincoln's mother was an ordinary woman. Her past was not above reproach. And Lincoln's stepmother, who raised him throughout most of his life, was much in the same mold and pattern. If one added up all of the education achieved by the three generations of grandparents and great-grandparents of Lincoln, one would find that they could not qualify for a single high school diploma. There was little of culture and of cultivation in the Lincoln home. The children and stepchildren, the mother and the father, lived in a single room or a single lean-to. The floor was dirt-covered. There were no books. There was little of what we call gentility, little of what we can call manners. Lincoln, throughout the first 14 of his years of his life, was in school for one school semester. And after his 14th year, he never entered a classroom again. And as one reads this record of the early Lincoln, one wonders if we had been parents in New Salem in the 1820s, whether we would have encouraged our children to become friendly with the young Lincoln. After all, today we seek to win for our children the friendship of the young boys and girls from the so-called better homes. We flee the areas of a community in which the ordinary people live, the Thomas Lincolns and their families. And yet what a rare privilege it would have been had any of our children been able to have a childhood and lifelong friendship with our future greatest president. Lincoln's biography is disturbing. In the 1830s, Lincoln was a young man determined to achieve something for himself, to make something of his life. He was busy at night studying law, reading after 14 hours of odd jobs, for Lincoln in his middle 20s was not able to hold down any single financially secure vocation. He was a boatsman, woodsman. He chopped rails for the local farmers. He bundled bales in the local store. He had made the friendship of the village lawyer and of the village school teacher. He had joined the New Salem Debating Society. But his prospects were not bright. And one cannot help but wonder if we lived in Springfield or in New Salem in the 1830s, whether if our daughter had brought to our door as a suitor, the young Lincoln, we might not have suggested to her that she look for a more suitable match. For surely his prospects were not that bright. And surely there must be other more financially established young men in the community who could provide for her a better home and a more glorious future. Lincoln's life is disturbing. As Lincoln grew, he became a pretty fair country lawyer. His practice gave him a measure of financial success. But Lincoln was never an outgoing, free and easy personality. We've heard much of his ability to tell a tale, but we forget that he was introspective. He was given to moodiness. His manners were not what they should have been. He was not courtly or genteel in any way. A biographer of Mr. Lincoln quotes a contemporary account, a description of this man, which I should like to read to you. "To say that he is ugly is nothing. To add that his figure is grotesque is to convey no adequate impression. Fancy a man 6 foot high and then out of proportion, with long bony arms and legs which somehow seem to be always in the way, with large rugged hands which grasp you like a vice when shaking yours, with a long scraggy neck and a chest too narrow for the great arms by its side. Add to this figure a head cocoa nut shaped and somewhat too small for such a stature. Cover it with rough, uncombed and uncombable lank, dark hair. Hair that stands out in every direction at once. A face furrowed, wrinkled and indented as though it had been scarred by vitriol. A high, narrow forehead and sunk deep beneath bush eyebrows, two bright, somewhat dreamy eyes that seem to gaze through you without looking at you. A few irregular blotches of black bristly hair in the place where beard and whiskers ought to grow. A close-set, thin-lipped, stern mouth with two rows of large white teeth and a nose and ears which have been taken by mistake from a head of twice the size. Clothe this figure then in a long, tight, badly fitting suit of black, creased, soiled, and puckered up at every salient point of the figure. And every point of this figure is salient. Put on large, ill-fitting boots, gloves too long for the long, bony fingers, and a fluffy hat covered to the top with dusty, puffy crepe. And then add to all this an air of strength, physical as well as moral, and a strange look of dignity coupled with all this grotesqueness, and you will have the impression left upon me by Abraham Lincoln." One wonders if we had been members of Washington or Springfield society in the 1840s, whether we would have gone out of our way to make friends with the representative to the 30th Congress from Springfield, Illinois, or from the circuit lawyer who followed the circuit seeking his clients. Lincoln was moody, was hard to draw out. And somehow, most of us make free and easy friendships. We accept a somewhat superficial standard of companionability. And when someone does not seem to go easily into our crowd, to be a good mixer, we call it, we push them aside, we forget them, forgetting that the battered cover of a book does not in one whit mean that the text may not be brilliant and glorious. There are reasons then to wonder, to be disturbed as we rehearse the biography of Mr. Lincoln. But perhaps the question which disturbs us the most is whether we today would elect Lincoln as our president. If Lincoln had been in Washington during the past 10 years, it is doubtful that he would still command a large measure of popularity. Lincoln did not believe in diplomacy by sword rattling. After all, it was a young Lincoln who, in the years of 1847 and 48, in his one tour of duty as a member of the House of Representatives, it was this young Whig, Abraham Lincoln, who stood up in the House and who voiced his feelings that the American invasion of Mexico, the so-called Mexican War, was unjust and immoral. And where others were screaming, making the American eagle scream loudly, Lincoln was concerned whether or not America had not violated the basic principles of international relationships, and whether we had not sought out and found a pretext to gobble up and grab some territory, which our nationalists, the creatures of manifest destiny, were eager to add to the American nation. Lincoln lost his seat on the basis of that speech and these actions. But the young Lincoln was not one who felt that when morality was at stake, it was the duty of a politician to set the possibility of re-election above the necessity of speaking his piece. Lincoln did not enjoy the fact that increasingly, even in his day, there was an attempt to raise the so-called difficult issues of political life out of the arena of politics. Today we call it bipartisanship, which is an assumption that there are certain areas of political life which are better settled in committee than on the public forum and in public debate. Lincoln did not believe in this. Lincoln claimed that there ought to be free discussion of all areas of our national interest. And what Americans had to fear was not so much the inability of the electorate to make up its mind intelligently, but the unwillingness of those in power to give to the electorate the facts which would permit them to make up their minds intelligently. Lincoln, I don't think, would have enjoyed and would have spoken out against the vitriol and the vituperation which has featured so much of American policy. He was fond of telling a story of a traveler who was on a long journey, and during this journey he was surrounded by an intense black storm. It thundered and there was lightning. He lost his way. Occasionally, when the lightning would break through, he would get an instantaneous vision of the surrounding countryside. He would be able to see 10 or 20 feet ahead and go a little bit further. But the thunder itself shattered his very soul, drove him to his knees, and according to Mr. Lincoln, when he was on his knees, he uttered this prayer to God. O Lord, if it's all right with you, let's have more light and less noise. Lincoln was always for more light and less noise, more public discussion and less public vituperation, more debate and less diatribe. Mr. Max Lerner has completed a monumental study of our American civilization. In this study, he made certain observations on our current practice of election. He said in part, elections have tended to become more and more like a business sales campaign, with a voter playing the role of a potential buyer to whom a commodity must be sold. At this point, politics merges with the larger arts of salesmanship, packaging, and publicity. The history of American presidential elections can be partly written as the history of slogans which express the felt needs of the time and jived exactly with the mood of a particular moment. It is not that the slogans themselves and their repetition won or lost the elections, but that they were symbols for the interests and emotions which did. The campaign planners chart out their strategy much as they might chart out a national sales campaign for their commodity. In both cases, they call in the aid of the crack advertising agencies and the public relations firms. And as they test the effects of each tactic on the fever chart of the poll samplings, they shift emphasis and slogan, thus finding new wrappers in which to package the commodity they are seeking to sell to the voter. What is most dangerous about this mechanization of politics is that it threatens to dehumanize the political process itself, which is at the very heart of a human process. When the American corporation sells its product to a mass audience, using radio and television to capture their attention, its great fear is that the program may alienate potential buyers in certain ethnic, religious, or sectional groups. Something of that sort happens in a political campaign. A smart candidate will evade any issue which might bring him into head-on conflict with a sizable, organized group of voters. Since there are few issues that are safe in this sense, the trend is for the campaigner to speak in blurred generalities, except when he is appealing to a specific voting bloc or interest group and bidding for their support against his rival. The mechanization of the voter ends up in the dehydration of the candidate and of the issues. Perhaps Mr. Lerner has overstated the mechanization of our electoral process. But certainly Mr. Lincoln would today not be a safe candidate, a man given to speaking in generalizations about the crucial issues of the time. One of our issues today is the issue of anti-Semitism, anti-Negro feeling, the bombings, the riots, and so on. One of the issues in Mr. Lincoln's time was the growth of the Know-Nothing Party, a party of native racists and chauvinists who became very strong in America in the 1840s and 1850s, seeking the policy which the American First group spoke before the Second World War. Their target was not the Jew or the Negro in those days, but the Catholic, who for the first time was coming in large immigrant groups. It might have been politic not to alienate these people, for many of the Know-Nothings were members, technically, of the Democrat or the Republican Party. But Lincoln spoke out in terms which we can still admire, with a courage which we certainly still admire. I am not a Know-Nothing, that is certain. How could I be? How can anyone who abhors the oppression of Negroes be in favor of degrading classes of white people? Our progress in degeneracy appears to me to be pretty rapid. As a nation, we began by declaring that, quote, all men are created equal. We now practically read it, all men are created equal except Negroes. If the Know-Nothings get control, it will read, all men are created equal except Negroes and foreigners and Catholics. When it comes to this, I should prefer emigrating to some country where they make no pretense of loving liberty, to Russia, for instance, where despotism can be taken pure without the base alloy of such hypocrisy. Lincoln would not have been a candidate given to speaking in generalized terms. He would not have been given to being a candidate who would not meet head-on the crucial issues of political life in his day. We do not know what stand he would take on our problems, but his problems were the problems of the Union, the problems of slavery, the problems of the extension of slavery into the so-called free territories, and Lincoln met these problems with a clarity of logic and the sincerity of thought which we can only admire. The doctrine of self-right government is right, he said, absolutely and eternally right. But it has no just application as here attempted in the extension of slavery into Kansas and Nebraska. Or perhaps I should rather say that whether it has such just application depends upon whether a Negro is not or is a man. If he is not a man, Why, in that case, he who is a man may, as a matter of self-government, do just as he pleases with him. But if the Negro is a man, is it not to that extent a total destruction of self-government to say that he too shall not govern himself? When the white man governs himself, that is self-government. But when he governs himself and also governs another man, that is more than self-government, that is despotism. If the Negro is a man, why then my ancient faith teaches me that all men are created equal, and that there can be no moral right in connection with one man's making another his slave. Lincoln came from the near South. Southern influence was dominant in that part of the state of Illinois, which was his home. Lincoln's family had their roots in Kentucky. But Lincoln certainly would not have taken the way of equivocation, which has been the way of many of the senators and leaders of gentlemen in Congress from the border states, and tried to ride both sides of a moral issue. He would have spoken clearly and dramatically on the issue of the rights of education and of election and of voting, equal to all men. A candidate who is safe speaks in generalized terms. A candidate who is a safe candidate makes a country feel that they are on the way to an ever grander and more glorious future. Lincoln was prepared to remind America that the future may not be as glorious as others had painted it to be. That a grand, glorious American democratic future demanded certain commitments as to ideals and as to principles, and that unless these commitments were made, the American dream might turn into the American nightmare. Listen to this man. You have succeeded in dehumanizing the Negro. When you have put him down and made it impossible for him to be but as the beasts of the field, when you have extinguished his soul in this world and place him where the ray of hope is blown out as in the darkness of the damned, are you quite sure that the demon you have roused will not turn and rend you? What constitutes the bulwark of our own liberty and independence? It is not our frowning battlements, our bristling sea coasts, our army and navy. These are not our reliance against tyranny. All of these may be turned against us without making us the weaker for the struggle. Our reliance is in the love of liberty which God has planted in us. Our defense is in the spirit which prized liberty as the heritage of all men in all lands everywhere. Destroy this spirit, and you have planted the seeds of despotism at your own doors. Familiarize yourself with the chains of bondage, and you prepare your own limbs to wear them. Accustomed to trample on the rights of others, you have lost the genius of your own independence and become the fit subject to the first cunning tyrant who rises among you. Not only the slave, but the enslaver is damned by a policy tyranny. Would Mr. Lincoln be elected a president today? We can only conjecture. Would we as a people rally again to a man who is willing to take the dangerous path to election? The path of commitment, the path of principle, the path which will permit him to speak not the gobbledygook of politics, language of moral principle. I think we can. I think when such men rise again amongst us, Americans will, as they did in the age of Lincoln, elect them to the office that they deserve. But certainly a period of commemoration such as this, the annual birth date of Mr. Lincoln, is a healthy period of self-judgment for our American people. For Lincoln stands as a symbol of the American dream. He is proof of the validity of the American principle that out of the commonest earth can grow the most extraordinary man. It is not only the dream that from poverty a man can achieve success, But it is the principle that out of ordinary character a man can mold through self-discipline and self-mastery the most extraordinary character and self-control and personality. Lincoln stands as a symbol of the potential of achievement in American life, and he verbalized for the American people the outline of the dream which the fathers had created in the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. He brought slavery, freedom to the slave. He brought union to a disunited nation. He verbalized in his speeches the dreams and the aspirations of a people truly in their hearts dedicated to the principles of liberty and equality. His birthday calls each of us to re-examine our personal lives and our political lives in the light of these, the basic cardinal dogmas of faith, of Mr. Lincoln and of his people.